I'm glad you didn't say you were looking at sort of carrion beetles in the cemetery.
Well, I was. And, this is the thing. The other species was a carrion beetle, but it was one of the predatory ones. So it was that common snail hunter that we've already talked about.
So it wasn't feeding on dead people?
No.
Different side to Winter Watch. Hello, and welcome to Wilder Skies Podcast. My name's Nick Patel. I'm a birder, a conservationist, person of colour with a big passion for passerines. This is the place where we talk birds, wildlife, and all the hard-hitting conservation topics on the top of everyone's minds right now. This week, we're talking to Ash Whiffen, a self-confessed beetle nerd from the heart of Edinburgh. Ash works as a curator, working with all sorts of insects and beetles in the National Museum of Scotland. So a field worker and entomologist, she likes to spend a lot of time sifting through cow poos, looking for dung beetles. Because who doesn't? Join us as we dissect everything from museum life to British beetles, even to board games, and we throw a quiz in there as well. But on a serious note, Ash is so talented and super knowledgeable about her field, so it's great to have her on the podcast, and I really hope you enjoy the chat. And here's your reminder to stick till the end for your weekly dose of Nature Notes of the Week, where I divulge the latest and greatest up-to-date seasonal wildlife to be on the lookout for during this week. Next week, we'll be talking to Ali Rajabali. Ali is an incredible wildlife photographer from Birmingham. His passion for bird photography and macro insect photography is truly inspiring. His approach to ethical and non-disturbing wildlife photography is truly to be commended. Ali also works as a conservation officer. We hit one of the hard topics of how it is to work in the conservation industry as a person of colour. Right, without further ado, let's get into it. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, Ash, good afternoon. Amazing to have you on Wilder Skies. Lovely to see you.
Good afternoon, Nick. It's so great. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Thank you for being here. So for those of us in the nature sphere and those on social media, I think you'd have to be living under a rock not to know who you are. You are essentially Britain's leading crazy beetle lady.
Thank you.
But please, for our listeners, in just a few words, how would you describe yourself?
I mean, as that, to be honest. I'm an entomologist. I specialise in beetles. So yeah, that does make me a beetle lady, crazy beetle lady, because I am, yeah, fanatical about them. Yep. And I'm also a museum curator. So I work in Scotland at the National Museum of Scotland. As a curator, and I've been there for about 8 years.
Amazing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a crazy anything. You know, I completely accept the title of crazy bird man, and it just means you're hugely passionate, and that's cool. So going back to the very start, broadly speaking, because you're an entomologist, but you specialize in beetles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And specifically certain types of beetles. So mm-hmm. carrion beetles?
They are my jam.
Yeah. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one. I actually came into entomology via doing forensics. I did forensic science at university. And it was through that I really just started to see insects in a different way and see this application that they had. They could be used to solve crimes, like, so cool. So I got into the insects that are associated with dead stuff first. They were my gateway. So kind of a weird route. And then I got into other insects from that, but because that was my first foray into entomology, it's really stuck with me. So I just couldn't leave the carrion stuff behind. And so I met carrion beetles during my studies, and I just really kind of fell in love with them. So they are still my favorite group of beetles. And for anyone not familiar with them, they are part of nature's cleanup crew. Nature's recycling team, and they literally recycle all that organic waste matter that is corpses, whether that's a small mouse, a dead bird, anything. They'll even work together in groups if it's a larger carcass. So they're really essential for that kind of cleaning up and recycling of all that energy and nutrients.
Yeah, and that is so important, isn't it? You know, like vultures and red kites and things, you know, they're so important, and we need to be talking about them more and yeah, supporting them more. So carrion beetles and dung beetles are your main focus. What sort of happened where you were suddenly like, beetles are amazing?
Yeah, it was that introduction initially with the forensics, but then during my studies, I kind of learned a lot more about beetle diversity because I had no idea. I didn't think I really knew during my undergrad that there were over 4,000 different beetles in the UK. And that diversity isn't great. You know, like our biodiversity within the UK is kind of meager compared to other countries, and being depleted rapidly. But yeah, it's still phenomenal to have that diversity on our doorstep. And a lot of them are really, really small. But it was, yeah, through my studies and learning about this diversity that we have that really opened my eyes, because beetles are phenomenally diverse. They are, as it stands at the moment, they're the most diverse insect group in the world. So there's been over 400,000 species described globally. So that
That's
ranks them
incredible.
the most speciosus group that there is. But actually, in the UK, we do have more flies than we have beetles. So it was a very close call. I was almost a fly person.
Crazy fly lady. Yeah, I mean, that is such a huge number. I didn't actually realize how many there were, you know, worldwide. Is there a reason for that? Like, are they just so successful, or they just evolved to have so many different species, or?
It gets a little bit complicated when we get into their evolution, and it's not my strong point, but they evolved alongside flowering plants. And so actually beetles were among the first pollinators. They arrived on the scene way before bees did. And people don't often think about beetles as being pollinators, so I'd like to get that one across. But they also have evolved a really incredible body plan that's really robust. So their key feature being the wing cases, the elytra, as we call them. That means that beetles are really hardy. It means that they can travel around through the undergrowth, through leaf litter and soil, and keep their flight wings protected, and get into all those little nooks and crannies that other insects might not be able to. So yeah, it's that kind of body plan that's really benefited them. And then you've got different groups that have established sort of different shapes within that. So you've got rove beetles, you know, your devil's coach horse beetle. That's a rove beetle. And they're known for having that abdomen that's really like exposed. And they've got like short wing cases, but big abdomen. And they'll rear that up and kind of look really menacing with that pose. But that group, the rove beetles, are one of the most diverse groups of beetles because they've got even more maneuverability and flexibility with that body plan. So yeah, it's just expanded from there and really exploded in terms of their diversity. They're super successful.
Awesome. I mean, I was looking at the, I can't remember exactly what website it was, but I was looking at a website earlier of all the different species in the UK, or at least most of them. And they're all just so varied, you know, different shapes and sizes, and they're all complete, like each group's completely different. What is it which, what sort of family within the beetles is your like big family, which you would say is your number one that you
Oh,
like?
easy. That's the carrion beetles. I'm so
Okay.
biased.
So
I can't move away
is
from
that
them.
like, they're like the ones with the sort of black and orange and stuff like that? And are they predatory, or are they just feed on
They're
dung
interesting because they're a mixed
and
bag.
meat?
So carrion beetles, as their name indicates, mostly associated with the dead stuff. But actually, there is a few tree species in there. You're right. So you've got the family as a whole is called the Sylphidae, and it's split into two subfamilies. And you've got one subfamily, which are the burying beetles, the Necrophorinae. So they're all called Necrophorus as their genus name. And then the other side, the other subfamily, are the Sylphinae, and a lot of them are carrion feeders, but they don't have the same interesting behavior. So the burying beetles are the ones that are a little bit more well known because they have that incredible behavior of a male and female working together, locate a small dead mammal or bird, and then they bury it. They literally bury
Right.
underground so that they've got this little nest that's nice and safe from any predators and rival beetles where they can rear their
Yeah.
young. And then, sorry
Wow.
if anyone listening is eating at the moment, but it goes a step further. And then male and female will strip the carcass of any feathers or fur, mold it into a ball. They actually have oral and anal secretions that they cover the carcass in, which is a preservative and also acts as a deterrent to keep other beetle pairs away. And then they will pre-digest the flesh and regurgitate to the offspring, which is just so sweet.
That is
Remarkable.
fascinating. That is mind blowing, really. Like, you don't think
Wild.
of that going on outside under the ground. And why is do they decompose better underground as well?
I think that it helps preserve the food source for longer because
Right.
of eradicating that competition of the rivals. So you're not having to
Yeah.
share it. And then also that preservative as well. There'll be slight differences in temperature too. So if it's in the summertime, if you've got something above ground, that's possibly going to decay much faster because of that exposure to the heat. So
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
it's keeping it that food source for a bit longer, but mostly it's that competition. They're doing it to
Yeah.
avoid that competition. Because if you've got something above ground, you're going to have it, taken away by a fox, or
Yeah,
eventually a
yeah.
big bird is going to come along and have it too. So that behavior has evolved over time because of that competition pressure.
And presumably they must be really strong to move things much bigger than themselves.
A lot of beetles actually, if you held like one of the big dor beetles, one of the dung beetles in your hands, or one of these carrion beetles, you can really feel them pushing between your fingers, and that strength of them, it's pretty
Yeah.
remarkable. And they've
Wow.
got good kind of like front legs for digging. So yeah, and like
Yeah.
their heads are quite broad as well, which kind of act a bit like a shovel.
Yeah. Settle this for me because I love insects, but I'm also a bit fearful of some insects, and particularly perhaps some of the beetles. Is there a chance that they could nibble you?
Oh yeah, I mean they can, but it doesn't hurt and it doesn't draw blood. I've been nibbled by plenty of beetles, and it's just like a little tickle. Honestly, there's
Yeah.
none in the UK that we need to worry about for that.
No. Yeah, I'm happy with that because I have been bitten by a great diving beetle before, and that would be probably be one of the strongest bites.
I think so. That might be the worst.
That's probably what's put me off it. Not beetles, but just picking up beetles. I don't often pick up beetles, but yeah, I trust them more now. I trust them.
Good. Well, yeah, that beetle in particular, it's adapted to feed on everything from other aquatic invertebrates to tadpoles and actually adult frogs, and even fish, so small fish. So yeah, it has got quite
Wow.
strong mandibles.
So, you've mentioned there's like pollen beetles, and there's obviously carrion beetles and predatory beetles. What's the sort of like ratio? Like, is there more sort of carnivorous beetles, or is there more herbivorous?
That's a good question. I'm actually not sure how it kind of divides up. The majority of beetles have, well, all beetles have mandibles. They have these chewing mouth parts. That's another character that they all share. And a lot of them are therefore really well adapted as predators. So you have a huge number of beetle species which are predatory. But those mouth parts are also great for feeding on plant material. So you've got a lot that are herbivorous. A lot of the leaf beetles, obviously, as their name indicates, feed on plant leaves. A lot of the weevils are plant feeders. But then, and pollen feeders. But then you've got a lot that are saprophytic. So they're feeding on dead wood, and again, needing those really strong mandibles to break through that kind of organic matter.
Some of them are so colourful, and then some of them are so dull. We're just to look at.
Oh, yeah, you're right, though. You're right.
Let's be honest for a minute. Like, okay, you're a expert and an enthusiast, so you see them as the way that I see pipits. They can be very drab, but I understand they're amazing to you. Is there like is there a reason for some of those colors? Is it for like breeding, or is it like more of a safety thing, like deterring other things? What's the reasoning behind the really colorful ones?
It's a bit of a mix. So yeah, the main one is aposematic coloration. So your classic ladybirds, that's what they're using. They're utilizing that bright red or bright orange to deter predators from eating them there. So they're advertising that they taste bad, and to kind of keep away. And then you've got some beetles that don't, that actually will copy those insect groups, and mimic that because they know that that's a helpful color to be. Others, I'm not certain. So we've got the wonderful rose chafers that we get in the UK, and they're that gorgeous iridescent green. And both males and females are the same, so that's not a mate attraction thing. Potentially, it kind of confuses predatory species. So maybe birds are a bit dazzled by their iridescence; they can't quite, focus in on that. I know that for species elsewhere that are that gorgeous iridescent, it's been suggested that they kind of mimic like water droplets on leaves, which again help with the kind of camouflage.
Going back to what you were saying about the mimicry, particularly of, say, a predator, that is something that I completely almost overwhelmed with fascination by. Things like hornet clearwing
Oh
moths,
yeah,
just
yeah.
it's such an amazing evolution for them to be so exact in how they look, and just, it obviously works, and it's just so cool. I mean, yeah, it's so clever.
It's very successful. You've only got to look at the amount of hoverflies that are using that black and yellow striping to mimic wasps. It's so effective, and it really confuses everybody. You'll see it all the time in the media when they're trying to use a, their poor like content managers will go out to look for a picture of a wasp and they end up using a picture of a hoverfly.
Oh,
Classic
don't get me
taxonomic
started on
fails.
stuff like that. Obviously, you are into all sorts of beetles, colourful and non-colourful. But let's be honest, looking at your Instagram, there's some very colourful beetles in there. So if none of them were colourful, would you still be as interested in them?
Yes, I think so. And you'll still have that incredible diversity, just in their sheer size and structure. You just got to look at something like a stag beetle. They're not colourful. They don't need colour. They're just flipping fantastic enough on their own. So yeah, I think colour's just the extra bonus, isn't it?
And I suppose the process is for you as well. Like when you're talking about the carrion beetles and things, it's what's going on down there, which is just as
His
interesting as
behavior.
the appearance.
Exactly.
Amazing. So going back to dung beetles, as much as carrion beetles, you're also fascinated by dung beetles. Dung beetles, again, is something which I know nothing about. I don't even know if I've seen, I don't know if I've physically seen in person a dung beetle, which
You
may
must
sound shocking
have.
to you. I
You
know,
must
but
have.
I don't remember the last time I studied cowpat. So I don't really know, because unlike you, I'm not a professional poo botherer. So I don't really spend time looking for them, but surely they are fascinating as well.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, I am a professional poo
Such an
botherer.
important part of the ecosystem as well.
Yeah, they really are. But you don't have to be poking around in cow dung or anything to necessarily find them. I think the one that people most likely will encounter are the dor beetles. So those are our big dung beetles. They're in the family Geotrupidae. And they're like the big, bumbly, like kind of clumsy looking things, about, what, 3 centimeters long?
I have seen them.
And they've if you flip them over, they've got that amazing blue, violet, purple iridescence. So really striking. And you will see them sort of towards the end of summer in particular on paths. They seem to like be really noticeable on paths. And sometimes their mobility is slowed as well. I think that's when they're getting towards the end of their lifespan, and they're struggling a bit.
Why are they on paths?
Yeah,
Because
I
I
think
know
that's just
when
because.
you go to places like the uplands and things, you do often see them on the rocky paths.
I
Is there a
think
connection
it's
to that?
just that that's where we're noticing them because we're mostly on trails, so we're
So
seeing them there. But if you go off path, you find them a lot too. So through like some of my field work, I'll be going off path, like through the undergrowth, and I'll still find them then too.
Interesting.
But there, so that's probably like the most distinctive one and the one that people will most likely encounter. The rest of our dung beetle species, because we've got over 60 species in the UK, the rest of them are much smaller. So you're talking anywhere between 3 millimeters to 8 millimeters. Most the kind of most of them fall within that
That's a
category.
big difference, isn't it? Compared to the dour beetles. That's No wonder you spend more time seeing dour beetles than some of the other dung beetles if they're
You
that
really would
small.
have to be poking around in poo at that point because those guys are dwellers. So they pretty much just feed and breed within the dung, and they're only moving around to go and find a new dung source. Whereas the dour beetles, I think they're just much more visibly active. We don't have any that do the rolling in the UK either, which is a real shame. But that's just.
Oh, you mean like sort of David Attenborough Africa type? Have you seen that
I
in
have
person?
on my field work in Spain a few years ago was the first time I saw it, and I was in love. Like I sat and I watched these beetles for ages when I should have really been working, going off and finding different things, but I just wanted to watch that behavior. Amazing.
Amazing. But obviously in the UK, there's big talk about dung beetles at the minute, in terms of, say, healthy farm ecosystems and things like that. And they have taken quite a knock, haven't they, in however many recent years. Presumably, a lot of that is to do with things like antibiotics and things in cattle. And there's obviously a strong connection between dung beetles and healthy bird populations and things like that. So, would you be able to tell us about the sort of conservation side and some of the declines?
So it is. You're exactly right, and that is what's causing these declines. It is the use of ivermectins to treat livestock against the internal parasites that they suffer with, and it is, essential for doing that. But it makes the dung toxic for the dung beetles, and then that's causing declines in the populations. There was a big push to kind of look more into these declines by a group called Team Dump, which was the dung beetle mapping project for the UK. And that was fantastic because it utilized collections as well. So those researchers trawled through historic records so they could get proper baseline data to then compare and conduct surveys nowadays to see how these distributions and the populations are changing. I think they found at least four local extinctions of British species, which is awful. And unfortunately, there's not a lot that can be done, except for if some landowners, farm managers are able to bring livestock in indoors whilst they're treated with those antibiotics, that restricts the access to the dung. But not all farmers can afford to do that. There's a cost associated with that, moving your animals indoors. But there are a couple of wonderful groups that are engaging with the farming community and trying to raise awareness about dung beetles. As soon as you talk to farmers about dung beetles, they're so happy to hear that they've got them. They know how valuable they are for their soil health. For farmland birds too, really, really vital. So all that we can keep doing is spreading awareness, talking about how cool dung beetles are, how much we need them. And I know there's some great work going on because one of your other guests, David, he's working over on Isla at the moment, and they're doing some work on rearing dung beetles for the choughs, aren't they?
No, I did not know about that, but that sounds fascinating.
It's really cool. Nice bird beetle interactions there.
And I presume habitat is still quite important. So say you've got farmland birds, if the food's been taken away or been negatively affected, it's not just that, it's their habitats for breeding and living. So would a more healthy farm system, as in the habitat as well, does that benefit the dung beetles as well, or not? Is it literally just all about dung?
Yeah, it depends because, in a kind of a more natural environment, take away the big monoculture of animals, they'd be using other, wild animal dung, so deer, for instance. And you actually have some of the dung beetle species specialize on deer dung, and you're not likely to find some of those in cow or sheep dung. So if you had Kind of healthier, more diverse habitat around the farmland, then you're more likely to have dung from some of those other wild animals, which they could then utilize.
And is it just plant-based stuff, or will they go for like carnivorous animals, maybe foxes or badgers or whatever?
Yeah, they do. I've actually collected dung beetles from dog feces before. Not nice. Don't like doing it. It's, yeah. Always wear gloves, by the way.
Yeah.
But they are forced to use whatever is there sometimes.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Okay, so moving on to your work, and you work in a museum.
I
You
do.
work in the, tell me what, which museum you work in?
National Museum of Scotland.
National Museum of Scotland, yes. And you are a curator?
I am, yes, I'm a
Yeah.
curator.
So what's a curator? A curator. What's a curator?
Yeah, it's I feel like I'm basically a caretaker for this massive collection. So at National Museum of Scotland, we've got about 2.5 million insect specimens. That's a lot smaller than, say, the Natural History Museum in London, but it is a
Right.
reasonable size. I think we're in top three for the
That's a lot.
UK collection size-wise. Yeah, and it's certainly enough to be keeping you busy for a lifetime. So yeah, curators, we're kind of there to be caretakers, to look after these collections. So they do require maintenance. They need people constantly checking on them, checking that the environmental conditions are good for the preservation, checking that there's
Right.
no pests getting in and devouring the collections. But then also the main job is to make sure that that collection is accessible. So we're there to host anybody really that wants to come and view and work on the collection. So that
Yeah.
is everyone from, researchers, whether they're from universities or other museums, perhaps students that are learning the ropes with identification or doing specific projects. It might be interested members of the amateur community and the, local naturalists. But also we get requests from artists quite a lot as well to use the collections as inspiration. So it's a real pleasure to be able to provide access for such a diversity of like different reasons and different purposes. So one of the best bits is that I get to meet a whole host of really interesting people, and share that, your passion
That's
and
really cool.
wonder. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah. And I presume seeing things up close and personal is amazing. I mean, some of these species, you either A, just wouldn't see them, or you
Yeah.
might see them very briefly, or they're fast or something. And this way you get to see, yeah, a perfect specimen
Yeah,
in
I
most
get to see
cases.
them up close under a microscope and see all the little details. And I like to share that with people as well because so many people don't get the opportunity. Not everybody owns a microscope, they're really expensive. And so that's a nice thing to be able to do. But also, I kind of get to travel the world. I get to see a lot of the world's insect biodiversity without even leaving Edinburgh, which is phenomenal. I feel very privileged to do that. And so another part of the job is bringing that diversity to a wider audience. So we help develop and design and implement exhibitions and displays, and we tell stories about the insect world through the museum galleries and events, which is really fun. It's nice to be creative actually in that way. I like that.
It sounds like a really cool, varied job.
Yeah.
But I mean, some of the pictures you post about your job, it looks incredibly difficult. Like, it looks like something which is it stressful? It looks stressful, just, very pernickety and very precise. And
Yeah.
yeah, is it hard?
I mean, I guess some elements are. You do need a steady hand when you're working with insects. So yeah, that is a key part because obviously they are so fragile. So working with preserved collections, with specimens, they need a certain amount of a steady hand and a lot of care. But I am somebody that it's always really appealed to me, that kind of neatness and order. I'm very organized, so I'm that way inclined. So yeah, keeping things in very neat rows is something I get a lot of satisfaction out of. Things that are difficult is things like dissection. So a lot of our beetles need to be dissected in order to get that species identification. And that's still a skill that I'm still working on because depending on which family you're looking at, things can get really, really tiny, and you're working with micro pins to gently prise out those key characters, and it is very frustrating at times. But yeah, I think that's the other thing. So the reason that we still collect and we have these collections is because identifying insects on the whole, it can be pretty hard. It's wonderful to have that diversity, but with diversity comes that, challenge of identification.
Sounds incredible. Have you ever dropped anything or broken anything? Like, have you ever, I mean, if you don't want to say, but surely it must be, there must be some frustrating elements to it where things just don't go your way.
Yeah, definitely. I think a curator would be lying if they said they'd never done that. We all had to learn some way. Sometimes I feel like with a really old specimen, you just got to look at it wrong and a leg will fall off or a wing will come off. Because yeah, they really are. Some of them are so fragile. So some of the lids of the drawers have quite such a good seal on them that you have to be really careful as you prise them open that you don't get this draft of air coming in and then the specimen's kind of resurrecting and the wings all flapping. So yeah, it's just things that you learn along the way. And the thing that I did break in the last year was I was preparing a tiny stag beetle, sorry, a rhinoceros beetle for display, and they are really small. Our species of rhinoceros beetle is only kind of a centimeter in length. If you haven't seen it, Google it. Absolutely adorable. But I had remounted a specimen of that to go on public display, and just as I was transferring it, one of its tarsi came off. It pinged off, and so we're talking like something that's a millimeter in length. And I was on my hands and knees under my desk with a magnifying lens, trying to see if I could find it to glue it back on. I didn't find it. And it ultimately, this specimen replicated an individual in the wild, because they don't, always look pristine. But beetles quite often will lose a leg and they can still carry on without it. So, and because it's so small to the average member of the public viewing that display, they're not going to notice that that 1 millimeter little foot is no longer there. So it was okay.
That must have been so frustrating. What are most of the specimens? Are they old ones or are they new ones? But what's the sort of divide?
Yeah, so the majority is historic. Our collection has been growing for the last 200 years. So some of our oldest specimens are about 250 to 230 years old. And yeah, a lot of it is very old. But we are adding to it all the time. We're developing the collection, and we need to do that in order to learn more about what is happening with our insect biodiversity. So it's always very targeted now. So the collection kind of grows depending on the expertise of the people that are there working with it. So myself and my colleagues, like obviously the areas of carrion beetles and of fungus gnats, which is what my boss works on, those areas are growing at the moment because that's what we study. And so when we go out on surveys or on field work, we're usually targeting those things. But then it's also growing depending on like the people
Oh, so it's
that relate.
actually it's you who brings the specimens in. I thought it
Yeah,
would be
part of
more
it.
like donations or,
Well, yeah, this is also it. So then it's also grown depending on the collections of the people that donate to us. A lot of those are lepidopterists, so we do get a lot of big moth collections, sometimes beetle collections, sometimes.
Really? That's really cool. That's really cool. I just wanted to go back way back again to you mentioned about ladybirds. I can't exactly remember what we were talking about, but is it called a ladybird or is it called a ladybug? What's the correct term? And if it is ladybird, what does it have to do with birds?
Oh, do you know, I don't know that. I don't know the answer to that question, but it all depends on where in the world you're from. So if you're from North America, you say ladybug. And if you're from the UK, you say ladybird. And I'm not sure where that originated from, actually. I probably should know.
That's not a good enough answer, Ash, because I
No,
need
I'm
that was
not
the one I needed
into.
to know because it's bird related.
I feel
It's
like
not
that's
good.
probably going to be more of a folklore thing or something. And that's, yeah, it's not scientific, is it? It's not.
Is folklore not scientific?
Oh, sorry.
but harlequins, you know, the invasive species,
Yeah.
are they still an issue in the UK or are they okay now? Because originally people thought they were taking over sort of native ladybirds, or are they just part of society now?
I mean, they are here to stay, definitely. But they are still, an added layer of competition for our native species. So I
Yeah.
know that, like the seven spot, and some of the other species that they, yeah, they're direct competitors. So they will be negatively impacting those native species.
Yeah. And one species which I'm quite interested to know if you know anything about. So on the last reserve that I worked at, there was one particular beetle, which I'm sure you'll probably guess as I'm speaking about it, which was wreaking havoc. And it was devouring a lot of hazels, limes, but particularly alders. Yeah. So obviously the older leaf beetle is spreading more and more. And on the reserve, we didn't particularly notice that the trees were dying, but we did notice that the numbers of the beetles was going up and up, and particularly the trees that had had a lot of these beetles on. They looked like they were leafless during summer. Are they going to, do you think they will cause a big issue for some of our vegetation?
Do you know what? It's such a weird one because that's a beetle that was believed to have gone extinct from Britain. And then there's been this like massive resurgence.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a funny one. Like, was it just underrecorded? Like, is it now because people know what to look for, especially with the
Yeah.
damage? Because yeah, it is really distinctive. I don't know. It's on the
Yeah.
RHS as one of the like pest species.
Yeah, but they are beautiful though.
Yeah,
They are a
they
stunning
are.
blue colour.
RHS say that it, although it can look worrying with the defoliation that it causes, the
Yeah.
trees usually bounce back.
Right.
And yeah, if it is native, then
It's just
it's
helping
a
the
just a
beetle.
natural process, right?
Yeah.
But it does seem to be so numerous now. Like I see all the records coming on all the
Yeah, yeah,
beetle
yeah.
groups and yeah, it's funny.
Interesting. Like with the harlequins and stuff, these sort of topics do raise different sort of sides from people. You know, some people
Yeah.
get really aggressively like squish them and yeah. Well, it's the same with any sort of invasives.
It just made me think of the spotted lanternfly in the US at the moment. So that is a non-native that's getting, yeah, it could go really out of control. And so there are
Right.
campaigns that encourage members of the public to squish the spotted lantern
Yeah.
bugs.
Yeah.
But and it's very distinctive. It's quite unique looking. So
Right.
I think the thought there is that people aren't likely to confuse it with anything else. But I do worry with campaigns like that that encourage people to just squish insects because they might take
Yeah.
that step further. Like somebody that just doesn't like insects anyway might
Yeah,
think,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I'm just in doing this and I'm going to squish all insects. So
Yeah.
make me a bit nervous.
Yeah, it's a bit like spiders. Like we're sort of trying to get away from that sort of, you
Yeah.
know, step on the spider. And even, yeah, I don't like spiders, but I wouldn't squish one. I have a really weird relationship with insects because there's certain I'd say that most insects I love, and there are certain things like butterflies and moths which I'm fascinated by. But I'm just insects still creep me out. And I don't know what it is. I think when I was younger, I watched a lot of things like David Attenborough. And even though things like the rainforest settings amaze me, and I'd still love to see it, the idea of lots of insects around, I don't know. That's my sort of nightmare, you know, lots of creepy crawlies. But yeah, I'd love to go to the rainforest and see those sort of things. But I don't know if I'd cope.
I think it's the fear of the unknown, isn't it? And I think to so many people, insects, they don't know much about them. You don't know, like you said earlier, like you don't know if something's going to bite you. And so that's an instinct to protect ourselves. You know, don't pick something up if you don't know if it's going to bite or sting you. And I think that when, if you're with somebody that can say, oh no, that one's absolutely fine, like pick it up, and then they show you and you get that confidence and you can see it with fresh eyes, I think that's what it takes. So I'm a big fan of all these people that are out there spreading that awareness and that love and showing that insects on the whole are really harmless, because that gives people that you know, it settles that fear and it gives them that confidence that, oh, that's not going to harm me. So yeah, I think if you knew that you were going to be safe, then you would be fine. I'm talking as a former arachnophobe as well, by the way. So I used to be
Really?
very, very bad with spiders, very, very
Yeah.
bad. But I
And
am fearless.
what made you not afraid of spiders?
I'm gonna plug a course now. The Friendly Spider Program at London Zoo would
Oh.
absolutely recommend it to anybody that suffers with
Yeah.
arachnophobia. It is wonderful. I was very sorry, doubtful initially. It was my graduation present from my parents from my undergrad, because I'd had to use pitfall traps for my project, and I would, as well as getting beetles in those, I would get spiders, and I freaked out knowing how to deal with them. So they were like, if you're going to be an entomologist, you need to cure your fear of spiders because they're so closely related. You need to sort that out. And I think I'd also just been a right pain growing up, having little tantrums and not wanting to sleep in my own bedroom because there was a spider there. So I did this course and it totally turned things around for me. I would quite happily have a pet tarantula or something now.
That's brilliant. I'd like to talk briefly about eco anxiety. So, this time of year can be quite hard anyway, but then with everything going on with environmental issues, conservation, biodiversity crisis, how do you deal with eco anxiety? And yeah, it can be incredibly overwhelming, can't it? And there must be days when you think, oh, it's too much. But yeah, what sort of things do you like to do to tackle those sort of feelings?
Yeah, I think I'll be brutally honest and say sometimes I don't. Like sometimes you just got to sit with that feeling for a bit, like accept it and go, right, this is how I'm feeling. Process it and then try and, you know, distract yourself a bit. I feel like I've got a friend, I'm lucky, I've got a fantastic network of friends and family. So I am always able to talk about any mental health issues and anxiety and worries. So that's really great. And first and foremost, I'd always say like talking about it is always really helpful. And also just even, you know, online in this cool like nature bubble that we have, we all share this feeling together. So I feel grateful to have met a lot of people through through social media in that way. So you know that you're not alone. That really helps. So it's hard because we all care so much. And then therefore, when you've got those worries, maybe you don't necessarily want to then go and read about insects or, you know, go out and look for birds, because those are the things that you're worried about and that set off those emotional feelings for you. So to be honest, sometimes I'll sit and binge something on Netflix, something that is totally different from what I work on and what I love. And I just need that bit of detachment. I've also got quite into board games at the moment, so that's another thing I'm doing.
Oh, board games are the future of the obviously they're the past, but they are the future. I'm really getting into a board game jam at the minute, and yeah, completely agree.
Please tell me that you're obsessed with Wingspan.
So
Oh, no.
I have Wingspan, but it's complicated, as in it's very complicated to learn how to play it. Looks amazing. So what I will say is I'm the sort of person who can't read books if there's no pictures, right? So Wingspan is beautiful to me, but I find it difficult because the rule book is like an actual book.
It is. It's quite big.
Yeah. Do you
Yeah,
enjoy
it took
it?
me a while to get to grips with it. My other half had to really kind of lay it down very simple. Like, this is how I do it with lots of practice runs. But yeah, I love it now. I
Yeah.
yeah, I'm still a bit rubbish at it, but I just enjoy it. And I think you know that you've got a good game when you keep losing, but you want to play again.
Yeah. Is there any Beetle games?
Oh gosh. I don't own one other than Bug Bingo, which,
There's a
everyone
market
knows
there.
about Bug Bingo. Yeah, potentially.
Maybe that should be your next project.
I think there is a really old game which somebody tweeted about once. I don't know if you can still get hold of it. I don't know. I'll have to look into that. Yeah. Another one that I really enjoyed that we got my way a real
No, go
sidetrack
for it.
now.
I love board game chat.
That we got my parents for Christmas was Cascadia. Have you heard of that? That's a really good one.
So, okay, this is going to sound like a really lame theme, but I have that, but I haven't played it.
Oh, you
I do
must
know how
play
to play games. I just, yeah,
It
got so
sounds to
many
me
games I
actually
haven't
like you're
played.
just a board game collector, Nick. Is that
Yeah, I just like look. I like looking at the covers and then hoarding them in my
right?
room. I just like stacking them. Yeah, no, I do have that game, and I definitely want to delve into it. I'm on a rapido type
That's good.
mission at the minute. Anything which involves lying, anything like I don't know if you've played the game Chameleon. I absolutely love it, where you
No.
just have to. Yeah, it's not great if yeah the best trait that you've got when it comes to board games is deception, but yeah, we all have our things that
Says a
we love.
lot about you.
Hey. So, speaking of games, I have a intermittent quiz here for you, right?
Okay.
So, this is either going to go down really well or it's going to prove that you know nothing. Okay. So,
I'm not worried.
basically, okay, right. So, let me discuss what it's about first. So, basically, I've taken 9 pictures, 10 pictures from your Instagram. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And I've got their descriptions, and these are all
Right.
Beatles. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and they're from all over the world, but you have to tell me what Beatle it is based on
Okay.
your description. And I'm just going to leave in a blank of where the name is. Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to count how many you get. And this will basically tell us if you're a true Beatle nerd or if you're lying to
Oh
us. Okay, right. Are you ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, first one. The da-da-da is a leaf beetle with a bit of a bad reputation. They're considered pests of da-da-da plants, but hey, they can't help it if they have expensive taste.
It's an asparagus beetle.
It is. Ding,
Yeah.
ding. You got that one. Well done.
They're
Okay.
really pretty, those beetles.
Yeah, the picture looked incredible. In fact, let's get the picture out so I can see which one. Yeah. Very almost soldier beetle-like, or is that offensive?
No, that's got kind of that kind of coloration going for a leaf beetle, yeah.
Cool. Okay. Was that hard or was that easy?
That was easy.
Okay.
Next.
Okay, it's getting harder then. Another beautiful da-da-da beetle from fieldwork earlier this year. You can see how the bright orange color is produced by hundreds of tiny scales. And if you need to know, I can give you, if it's not British, I can give you the location.
Beetle scales. My mind's going to weevil, but I don't, there's no orange weevils that I've posted.
It's not a weevil.
What's the location?
Spain.
Spain. Oh, it's one of the monkey beetles.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot about those. Yeah, because we mostly got these pale green ones, absolutely stunning, but there was a couple of yellow ones that we got as well. But yeah,
Okay.
yellowy orange.
Brilliant. Very interesting color, actually. Yeah, really cool. Number three. Time for another beetle fix. Here's a beautiful da-da-da from fieldwork earlier this year. These impressive beetles average at about 2 inches in length with striking red bands on the abdomen.
Oh, is this an oil beetle?
What kind of oil beetle?
Oh, it's the one from Spain. I
I
don't
mean, the
remember
clue
its
was in the
scientific
name.
name. It's a
Oh,
Meloe.
no. You can have the English name if you know it.
I think I don't know it. You've really gone back into the archives here. This is
Oh, that's
about 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
yeah. I'm testing the knowledge at the back of the brain.
Red striped oil beetle. I
Yeah,
don't know. Is
correct.
it?
Yeah, and also, very cool looking as well.
Yeah, because of all of ours in the UK are black, and some of them have got a really nice blue iridescent sheen to them. But yeah, this one, the Spanish one, was really nice because it had that bright red pop along the bands of the
Yeah,
animal.
they look really nice. Like when you look at a grill at the top of the oven, it looks like
Like they're on
that.
fire, yeah.
Yeah. Number
Glowing.
four. This beautiful beetle, da da da, is from my favorite beetle family, Sylphidae. Is that how you say it? Sylphidae? And
Yep.
is found in Southeast Asia, where it is associated with rotting fish.
This is that gorgeous blue iridescent one, which is, oh, there's been a name change. Necrophylla formosa.
Yeah, correct. You're doing really well. And to be honest, yeah. I mean, even knowing the Latin names is amazing because birds is my thing, right? I know no Latin names. I know Apus apus, which is swift. I know Buteo buteo, which is buzzard. I know Puffinus puffinus, which is Manx shearwater.
I see a
And
theme.
repetitive. Although I do know Bombycilla garrula, which is
What's
waxwing.
that? Oh, very nice. Yeah, the scientific names are hard, and I think that's what puts a lot of people off with insects because most insects don't have common names.
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
like with moths, micro moths. I would definitely spend a lot more time delving into the world of micro moths if they had English names. But they don't.
Yeah,
So,
there is a push to create more name, more common names for micro moths. So watch this space. It divides the entomological community because not everybody thinks common names have value. But as a science communicator, I champion the common names.
you do believe in common names.
Yeah, they have a place. They definitely have a place.
What is it which people don't like about them?
I think the traditionalists, that
Oh, those people,
possibly they're
right.
people that also find it quite easy to use the scientific names, so they don't struggle and don't have that same anxiety about pronunciation. But maybe they're also not communicating with the general public. And yes, kids are able to learn dinosaur names at a very young age, so everybody's capable of learning insect names too. But common names will attract a much broader audience, and we need as many people as possible to pay attention to insects and love insects. So I think they're absolutely fine. We need to embrace them.
Brilliant. Okay, number five. This species is one of the carrion beetles that has no association with carrion. Instead, it is a feisty predator of da-da-da,
Snails.
a common and widespread species in the UK, most easily found at this time of year, overwintering beneath fallen logs or under their bark. Stale.
It is the common snail hunter, Phosphuga
Correct. That's probably the first beetle that I saw you post on Instagram. And that blew
attrata.
my head because, yeah, just never heard of anything like that. A snail hunting beetle. I mean, I reckon most people think of beetles as relatively docile and just, pretty relaxed sort of things. But yeah, hunting a snail,
Yeah, they're pretty
bonkers.
badass. And also, that's a super common species. Like, you just got to go down to your local park, local woodland, flip over some logs at this time of year, or prise some bark off, or look under moss, and you might find one. I actually, my parents have left some dead wood out in their garden, which I love them even more for. And I thought, oh, I'll just have a little check to see if we've got any common snail hunters here. And they had three. So, yeah,
That's
you can find
amazing.
them.
So, number six, this pair of da-da-da beetles helped us promote entomology during Edinburgh Science Festival last year.
Were they dung beetles?
No, incorrect.
Oh.
I'm going to take that one as incorrect because I'm plucking for you to get one wrong here because you're getting something
That's mean.
right.
Okay, then it was carrion beetles, so the burying
No.
beetles. What?
No.
What else did I
No.
use? A pair of
Think
beetles.
bigger.
Oh, I obviously borrowed them because I've never reared any really big ones on my own. They're not stag beetles. Oh my goodness, Nick.
Diving
What?
beetles.
Diving beetles. Oh yeah. Edinburgh
Yeah.
Science Festival. Yeah, of course. We went pond dipping and then we had like some live beetles swimming around. Oh, yes.
So, for anyone listening,
I'm a
if Ash ever talks about diving beetles, she knows nothing.
fraud.
So, number seven, also known as da-da-da, these large da-da-da beetles are often attracted to light. Did you know we have two species in the UK?
Repeat that one.
Also known as da-da-da, these large da-da-da beetles are often attracted to light. Did you know we have two species of them in the UK?
Oh, it's Maybugs or cockchafers.
Yeah.
Now, most people think that we just have one species, but we have two. And that's because we have the northern, or like the more scarce species. So in Scotland, that's actually more likely that you'll encounter that one. So they're both called Melalonctha. The one in the south, or the most common one, is Melalonctha Melalonctha. So that's one that you might be able to hold on to.
Yeah.
And the northern one is Melalonctha Hippocastani. And you can tell differences
Yeah.
between the there's a difference in color of their pronotum,
Yeah.
and also their bum end. They have this kind of like long skinny structure which is called the pygidium, and that's a slightly different shape in the two species.
Yeah. And also, if you ask the northern one how it's doing, it says, "Hey up."
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, number eight. I found a species of da-da-da that I hadn't seen before, and this is possibly a new record for Scotland. Exciting, right? These da-da-da were on common toad flax at Meadows Yard Local Nature Reserve.
I
Easy.
remember that this was a weevil, but I cannot remember its scientific name.
So it was Rhynusa. Is that right? Rhynusa antirrhinin. Enter it in. Yep.
Yeah, I believe you.
It's
I
just
know it
so
was
weird.
right at the time of writing it. Yeah, I mean that goes to show you like we do not all retain these scientific names, and that weevil I don't think has a common name if I didn't write one down at the time. So I was really excited about that one. I'd identified it, and then I had one of our leading weevil experts in the UK check it for me.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I'm never fully confident if it's not my own group.
That must have been a really good feeling, though, to find a new record.
Yeah, it's always nice. I had another one. Hopefully it's not one of your other questions, but had a beautiful clarid, which is a lovely little iridescent blue beetle, clubbed antenna, really, really small, maybe about 4 or 5 millimeters. Had that in a dead seal on the Isle of Bute, and that was a brand new record last year for the
Yeah, I was going to ask about that one, but then, yeah, it does make me laugh that most people who would see a dead seal on a beach would either A, run a mile, or B, find it fascinating that there's a dead seal there, and then there's just you who ignores the seal and goes straight for the insects. Yeah,
Someone's got
amazing.
to do it.
Right, two more. First beetle of 2021. I didn't have to travel far to find my first bug of 2021. A da-da-da beetle. This cheeky beetle was in my flat.
This was a golden spider beetle, I think.
Yeah, correct.
Nyctis hololucus or something.
Yeah, well done.
Oy.
Very unique looking thing as well.
Yeah, very golden, but is considered a pest. Unfortunately, it's not one we would want in the museum, let's put it that way.
Oh, really? So I've got two more questions. One of them is a picture one and one of them isn't. So bringing the bug love on this Valentine's Day, this charming little tree bug, da da da, is in the family, da da da, and is a sap-sucking plant feeder. Most importantly, it has an adorable heart-shaped marking on its back. Oh.
I can picture the bug, but I can't remember its name. Yeah, it's black and red, isn't it? Oh no, it's not. It's the smaller one that's kind of
Not.
brown and yellow and black.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh
Nice.
gosh, I do not remember what that one is called. And I don't think it has a common name, does it?
No. So it's one of the sort of mirrored bugs,
Yeah, that's it.
and it's Lygus pratensis.
Yes, okay.
Really cool heart mark, though.
But to be fair, that's a bug, not a beetle.
So
I'm sorry,
you're
don't.
posting fraudulent information as well as non-beetles. Wow, it's all coming
No,
out.
just I'm less likely to retain the bug names because I need to make space for the beetle names, is what I'm going to stand
Okay,
by.
it's all right. It doesn't matter if you're not as intelligent as you say you are. So last question, not from a picture, bonus question.
Okay.
This is my own question. This beetle is named after a common US garden bird.
Oh, garden bird. It's not a robin.
I've seen one of these, the beetle. I've only seen one once, and it is, yeah, rather beautiful.
Gosh, my mind's drawing a blank.
It may not be named after bird, but it's the same name.
Same name. All that's running around in my head is like Blue Jay.
The Blue Jay Beetle.
I don't know. Put me out my misery.
A cardinal beetle.
Oh, do you know what? I just had a vision of a cardinal in my head. Of course, of course.
I thought that was going to be
Oh,
really easy, but I suppose it's quite obvious, so it probably makes it harder.
cardinal, yeah. What a wally.
Yeah. So you scored 7 out of 10.
Oh,
So
rubbish.
that's not too bad. No, that's not too bad. I would just like to briefly talk about Winter Watch. So you were on Winter Watch, correct?
I was, yeah.
Yeah. So for anyone who hasn't seen it, what was going on there? What were you showing?
I very briefly had the pleasure of showing Gillian round one of my favourite urban green spaces in Edinburgh. Because they were part based in Edinburgh for this recent series.
Yeah.
And it is a cemetery. So I hang around in cemeteries in my spare time. It's a really special place because it's a garden cemetery. So it was designed in the Victorian times as being a place for the wealthy to be buried where they had beautiful big
Yeah.
trees. So yeah, it was designed as a garden cemetery. And it is being maintained in a way that is, is good for nature. So it's not like most cemeteries that you'd encounter where they're really mowing the grass and spraying pesticides. They don't use any chemicals in the cemetery, which is wonderful. I should
Yeah.
say it's called Warriston Cemetery. It's very close to the Botanic Gardens. So it's a really nice area. It sits right on the water of Leith. And yeah, it's just one of those places that's a short walk away from me that has got really big trees. You kind of feel like you're in the middle of a woodland with a load of gravestones. And so yeah, it's just really a really nice peaceful place to go. And it was where I kind of stumbled upon during the lockdowns when I was looking to practice my bird ID because that was a thing that I picked up back then. So actually, I started going to Warriston for the birds and I stayed for the insects. So for Winter Watch, they got in touch because they were looking for places within Edinburgh and I suggested Warriston and then was asked if I wanted to show some of the insects there that you can find in winter. Now, finding insects in
Yeah.
winter can be a bit challenging, but actually cemeteries are a really good place to go and look because actually a lot of insects will use the gravestones to spend the winter on. So you get a lot of ladybirds and some other beetle species that will congregate in groups and cluster. And that's a tactic. So that's one of the species that we showed. Orange ladybirds in particular, which I've got a big fondness of because I actually did my master's on them on my research project. So yeah, they got some beautiful shots of orange ladybird clusters on gravestones, and I got to chat
So
about them.
you did your master's on ladybirds, but you can't tell me why they're called ladybirds.
Probably knew at one point, but that's just not a fact that I've retained. I'm sorry. What a fraud.
It's not okay. It's not okay. I'm glad you didn't say you were looking at sort of carrion beetles in the cemetery.
Well, I was.
And
This is the thing. The other
oh,
species was
okay.
a carrion beetle, but it was one of the predatory ones. So it was that common snail hunter that we've already talked about.
So he wasn't
And
feeding on dead people.
no.
Different
Well, then he
side to
was
Winter Watch.
still.
I'm sure if you were a dead person, that sounds weird. If you're a dead person, I'm sure you would want all the beetles to be happy
Yeah,
around.
I would be
Yeah.
thrilled.
Yeah. Was it nerve-wracking?
Yeah, I didn't want to do it actually. It's not something I ever sought out. In fact, when they came to me for
Too much
Autumn
for
Watch,
TV.
or being filmed at all, I have had to be filmed for
Yeah.
work a few times for internal
Yeah,
stuff
yeah.
now. I just don't like it. I'm very self-conscious. So I had managed to deter them when it came to Autumn Watch, and I put them in touch with some other people who were fantastic, but I
Yeah.
couldn't get out of it this time. And actually, I'm really glad I did it.
Yeah.
It did something for my confidence somewhere. Not massively. I will always feel very self-conscious about doing things like this, but I know that it's for the greater good. It's for, raising awareness of
Yeah.
insects, and that is one of my missions. So.
Just a few more questions or topics to talk on, a few more simpler ones. First of all, this could be a really easy question or a really hard one. What's your favorite beetle?
I can't. So people always ask this, and it is like I don't have kids, but it feels like I would be it's like being forced to pick a favorite child if you have multiple if you had 4,200 children and you had to pick one.
That would be expensive.
It would, yeah. None of you are going to university. So yeah, it's very challenging. I will always lean towards carrion beetles as being my favorite group. But it is very, very, very difficult to just pick one. It could change with day of the week. They all deserve the love and attention. So I'm afraid I
That's
cannot do it.
not the answer I was looking for.
I'm sorry.
There has to be one species
It
that you
doesn't.
just think is way better than the others.
I can't.
There must be one. It's okay, you can tell us.
No, I can't. What if
I won't tell the
what if the others
beans.
find out? I'll tell you one that's really cool within the carrion beetle family that we have in the UK. So one of the burying beetles we renamed as being the bent-legged burying beetle. And it's the only one out of the six species that we have that has really curved hind legs. So we gave it a common name. Previously it was called the common burying beetle, which is wrong because it's not the most common species. So when we published a book on these a couple of years ago, we gave it a new common name, and the one that would help with identification. So it's got these bent hind legs, and it kind of has this stance where it looks like a cowboy, looks like a cowboy, and it's like chaps, like it's the little John Wayne carrion beetle. So I really like that one. It's also got this golden, like this kind of collar behind the head on the pronotum of golden hairs. And if you get a fresh beetle, recently emerged adult, that little collar of golden hairs is really beautiful. So I quite like that one, but I'm not going to
You've said it now.
say
What would you like to see the most of a British beetle that you haven't seen?
Oh, that's a tough question because there's actually loads that I haven't seen. I'd love to see that the June tiger beetle for sure. I actually really, really, really want to see a stag beetle again. Yeah, the kind of service because I haven't seen one since I was a kid. So I did see them all the time. I was really lucky. Grew up in kind of Surrey, Berkshire area, and my grandparents had stag beetles in the garden like every year,
Wow.
and we used to play with them. We used to try and put sticks out and try and get them to grab on. And I think I totally took them for granted because I haven't seen one since. So I would really,
Yeah,
I'm
I'd
never
love to
down
see
south
one.
at the right time, but I need to
Yeah.
make an effort to try and see them this year.
Yeah, that would be really cool. They're the st sort of stuff of children's nature sort of heaven, isn't it? It's one of
Yeah.
those species that ev I think even everyone, if you saw one of those, it would, yeah, incredible and kind of not tropical looking, but you'd imagine seeing them on an African plane or
Yeah,
something,
because they're big.
yeah.
They are our biggest beetle that we have in the UK. So, yeah.
Right. Cool. Briefly, very briefly, let's have a quick chat about birds because I've probably followed you on Instagram for a couple of years and your birding level is just shot through the roof. And you are a, yeah, I mean, you're a birder. You're definitely a birder.
Yeah.
Someone who looks out for species on the bus. Is definitely a birder.
Yep.
Someone who goes to Twitch waxwings is a birder.
Yep.
Someone
Guilty.
who goes to look out for a king eider is a
Yep.
birder.
Guilty.
But you live in a pretty cool place for birds. Edinburgh must be, there must be some pretty cool birds around there, especially on the shore.
Yeah, very fortunate location-wise, but also I think this is my opportunity to very publicly say thank you, Nick, because you had a big influence on me. I got into birds during the lockdowns, and I got into birds because I needed a break from insects in the nicest possible way. I found I was just I'd succumbed to this pressure from the community where I felt like I had to be doing
Yeah.
entomology like all the time. And then when you do your hobby for your job, as I do,
Yeah.
like it you start to lose the fun. And I really didn't want to lose that. So not that I'll ever lose my passion for entomology, but it just became more like work. So I didn't want to spend hours at a microscope in my spare time, not only because it's antisocial, but also I wanted to give my eyes a break and like look for something else and learn a new skill.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
birding was the easiest one because at the time I had a camera with good zoom on. I didn't need to buy any fancy kit. I could just go outside and look,
Yeah.
and they were there. And I realized like my bird ID was shocking. Yeah, I could recognize a robin and a blackbird and maybe a blue tit, but I didn't know anything. And so I think, I don't know how, but I followed you and then I reached out to you for some advice, I think, on like bird
Yeah.
ID guides. And you
Yeah.
recommended the Collins bird app for the phone. And that was brilliant. But yeah, you've massively nurtured my interest and inspired me to carry on with it. I've always felt like you were a really brilliant person to go to for ID help because you never judge.
I appreciate
You're like the least judgy person. So I know that I can ask you
that.
a question and it's going to be a bit silly, potentially very
No, but
silly.
that's, I mean, it's like if I went to look for beetles. And this is, I've said this before, but one of the things that I'm hoping I'll sort of either myself or people who listen to the podcast will get across is just we're all backing up that passion for conservation and wildlife, and we're all sort of going in the same direction, but we all come from it from very different angles. And I think it's nice to sometimes say and see other people's passions, and just acknowledge that we can't all be passionate about the same things, but we can learn from others, and that opens your eyes to a whole new world. Right. Favorite place to see beetles, if you have a favorite place.
Oh, that's hard. The good thing about beetles is that you can find them anywhere, and I mean anywhere. At work, we've been like adjusting our grounds management plan so that we're a bit more nature
Yeah.
friendly, which has been brilliant. And we've been really pleasantly surprised in a kind of industrial estate with a bit of green space in a very urban city to have quite a diversity of beetles and other insects. So, yeah,
Yeah.
whether you've got just a tiny little patch or a local park nearby, you can find them.
Yep.
That said, it's always nice to see new stuff that I've not seen before. And so I have really enjoyed being further north in Scotland, especially in like the Cairngorms area. And then up
Oh.
near Torridon, Benet Nature, National Nature Reserve, where I've done a lot of field work recently. That's been amazing. And the Cairngorms in particular for beetles, because there is, those really ancient pine forests, it's so rich with Saprophytic species, so the deadwood feeding
Yeah.
species. So yeah, I've seen some like really nice longhorn beetles and things that I
Wow.
probably wouldn't have seen otherwise. And also I was really lucky with carrion. Found quite a lot of carrion on those trips, so that means I've found a lot of my favorite species, but also the larvae, which is something I'm really interested in now too. Larvae of beetles is very understudied in the UK.
So you've basically seen all the adults and now you're moving on to the
Yeah,
larvae.
need more of a challenge.
The Cairngorms is epic though, isn't it? It's just I don't know, it's just an oasis for wildlife. Yeah. Where would you say is your favorite place for wildlife in general? Like if you could choose one place to go any time of year, where would that be?
It's so hard to pick. I mean, like, there's so many places nearby for me, which I love. I really love going over to Musselburgh. It's got
Yeah.
the lagoons there, so it's awesome. It's great fun for birds. They've got the hides. But it's also pretty good for insects too. In the summer, they've
Yeah.
got huge areas over the links that are left to go to meadow now. So that's great fun, going
Yeah.
around there, finding pus moth caterpillars and chasing some of the day
Whoa, whoa,
flies.
whoa. That's something I forgot about actually.
Yeah.
Those pus moth caterpillars. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
So cool. And yeah, what really jealous of that, because that's one caterpillar I've always wanted to see. You just came across it.
Yeah, I found it consecutive years in that location actually. So whenever you're next
Wow.
up in Edinburgh, I'll send you the hotspot at near Musselburgh Lagoons to go and check for them.
Awesome. Well, that's about it. And yeah, another incredible chat, but I think probably the most, in the most positive way possible, the most unusual chat I've had so far, just because, yeah, it's incredibly fascinating. Well, thanks for coming on and speak
Thanks,
soon.
Nick.
Here's your nature notes for the weekend. And this week's target wildlife to look out for is the woodpeckers. That's right, I'm talking the head-banging drummers of the woodlands, kings and queens of the deadwood. In the UK, we have three species of woodpecker: grey spotted, which are the most common species; green woodpecker, which is the largest and obviously green, so quite different; and lesser spotted, which are smallest and the rarest. We do also have wrynecks as a visitor, but that's a story for another day. Throughout February, March, and early April, woodpeckers are displaying all over the country. Grey spotted woodpeckers are incredibly common and can be found through a variety of habitats, from parks to gardens to broadleaf woodland, even to coniferous woodland, and even places like golf courses. Slightly less widespread is the great spot. The green woodpecker, its range goes up to about the border of England and Scotland. They like heathland, they like decent meadows, but they also like woodland. But you will see them feeding more on the ground than the other woodpecker species because they'll come down to feed on ants. Now, lesser spotted woodpeckers are incredibly difficult to find. They are so rare in the UK now, and they're really small. But the display season in February, March, and April is the best time of year to find them. A, because they're displaying, and B, there's no leaves on the trees yet. As with all woodpeckers, the best way to identify a lesser spotted woodpecker is through its call and its drumming. Lesser spotted woodpeckers have a high-pitched call similar to a nuthatch or a kestrel. Great spotted woodpeckers have that classic chick 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 call, and green woodpeckers have that laughing yaffle. They all have different drumming noises as well, so it's important to look out for that one. Obviously, woodpeckers are quite elusive, and especially with the lesser spotted woodpeckers, they're very rare and they're very, very protected. So if you do find them, do not disclose where they are. The only people to get in touch with them about them is the BTO or the RSPB. So get out into those woodlands. I'm talking wet woodlands, semi-natural broadleaf woodlands, maybe pine plantations, but particularly those with native species and those with deadwood or wet wood. And look out for those woodpecker species. Listen for the calls, listen for the drumming, and look out for those undulating flights of various woodpecker species. Fly from display area to nesting area to feeding area. Good luck, guys, and get your woodpecker on. No, that sounded weird. I hope you find some woodpeckers. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Wilder Skies.
One, two, three.